Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Democracy may not be threatened by a revolution or a military coup, but it is in danger when there's an erosion of political norms, of our commitment, for example, to a free and fair elections or a free press, an independent judiciary. Where might these norms be weakening, and where might authoritarianism be on the rise? Joining me to discuss this question is Daniel Ziblatt. He's a professor at Harvard University and co-author of a new book, How Democracies Die. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron, VMware, and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation.
I wanted to sort of step back and look at the global context. You know, we've been told by Stanford professor Larry Diamond that, you know, democracy is retreating around the world. It's heading in the wrong direction. By Frank Fukuyama, who has said that, gee, between the early 1970s and the beginning of this century, there's extraordinary growth. Right? There's some like 35 to 110 democracies. And at the same time, we've looked at some broad trends, and I want to know how those trends may have affected the politics in various democracies. There's the information revolution, the decentralization of authority. There's economic globalization, and that's, you know, sort of the creation and concentration of wealth along educational lines. And finally, demographic trends. And I wanted to get a sense from you as to how those factors, as well as domestic political realities, may have affected things in European countries like Poland, like Hungary, like on the edge, Turkey, another NATO member.
Yeah, well, first, thanks for having me here. It's really great to be here. Coming from Boston, where it's getting wintry, it's nice to be in a sunny location. So, very good question. I mean, in many ways, we think about the United States as, because we're citizens of the United States, we focus on American politics very single-mindedly. But, of course, everything that's happening in the United States is happening within a global context. And there's this view that after the collapse of communism, the number of democracies in the world expanded, and then in the mid-2000s, we experienced a kind of period of democratic recession. If you look at the numbers, it's a little bit more complicated than that. I mean, there was certainly an explosion in the number of new democracies around the world after the collapse of communism, Africa, and Central Europe, and the former Soviet world. But really, beginning in the mid-2000s, you had a kind of flatlining of the number of new democracies. So there wasn't really, there were some new democracies that were breaking down and some new democracies that continued to come into existence. But the growth of this kind of explosive growth in the number of new democracies after the collapse of communism has definitely slowed down. In the last 2 years, there's actually been increased for the first time, really 2015, 2016. I mean, for the people who study this, and they're all of, you know, people who kind of code countries as democracies or not, there's beginning to be a recession in the number of democracies. Mm-hmm. And so the question is, why is this happening? And, you know, on the one hand, I think part of this is driven by the natural sequence of things. I mean, anytime, if you look back, there's been these moments of democratic expansion after 1918, at the end of World War I, after 1945. There tends to be these periods of democratic growth and then democratic recession. And often there's a kind of real exuberance for democracy and global pressures for democracy. But it turns out the kind of preconditions for democracy in a lot of countries aren't fully there. So if you're a rich country, you tend to be more democratic. So high GDP per capita. And if you've had a lot of democratic experience as a country, mm-hmm. the older a democracy is, the more likely democracy is to survive. And so a lot of new democracies and a lot of poor democracies, where things look very promising at one point, they are beginning to look less promising. So that's kind of the moment that we're living in. And a lot of these big trends that you're talking about are certainly exacerbating that.
So what about the role of having a robust middle class, an educated yeah. middle class? I'm thinking of Germany, because, yes. of course, it had yeah. experience with both democracy and autocracy. So what... Yeah. Fascism. What is the role of having a kind of an educated, broad-based middle class?
Yeah, so this goes along with in general, wealthier countries have bigger middle classes, more educated populations. All of these things are correlated with the robustness of democracy. And historically, these were the collective groups that pushed for political rights, the expansion of political mm-hmm. rights. And so that's really a crucial precondition. But again, you know, I sometimes think that, you know, as for people, as they get older, the probability of dying at a certain point begins to increase. Democracies, by contrast, as they get older, the probability of dying decreases. I mean, as democracies, old democracies basically don't die. And so how these countries become old democracies, partly because of wealth and, you know, robust civil society, robust middle class, and all of these things are certainly preconditions. But it's they don't guarantee democratic survival. I mean, Brazil today, that recently just had a presidential elections, had a vibrant, growing economy, a growing middle class, and yet a lot of people voted for essentially an autocrat.
Mm-hmm. Mexico.
Yeah, I think Mexico is less of there's certainly been increased polarization in Mexican society. You've had the breakdown of the parties, mm-hmm. of the established political parties, and so you've had kind of new populist parties. But it's the in our book we propose what we call a litmus test, authoritarian litmus test, where we try to identify characteristics of political leaders that once they're in, before they come into office, once they're in power, they may act as authoritarians. And so the authoritarian litmus test includes things, does the politician attack the media? Does the politician reject the legitimacy of their political rivals? Does the politician reject the basic constitution? These are the kind of key elements of a litmus test. And we developed this actually drawing on a great Spanish political scientist writing in the 1970s, Juan Linz, who proposed this as a way, drawing on his studies of interwar Europe, Latin America in the 60s and 70s. And so what's the benefit of this litmus test is that it allows us to identify potential authoritarians. And so there, you might not like somebody's policy. Somebody may be a populist on economic policy or right-wing on economic policy, but they're committed to the basic rule of the game. And I think in the case of Mexico, we don't have an authoritarian, whereas in the case of Brazil, this is somebody who's clearly violated this authoritarian litmus test.
Before we move on to others, I wanted to ask you to differentiate between liberal democracy and electoral democracy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, historically, elections are certainly a necessary condition, and today are necessary precondition of democracy, but elections aren't enough. We need to have, when I think about democracy, I think about democracy as you have elections for the most important offices in the country, but you also have civil liberties and civil rights. And that's what I think is the heart of liberal democracy, is combining both elections as well as protections for minorities, ideological minorities, ethnic minorities, political minorities through civil rights and civil liberties. And so that's a kind of a hard combination. We tend to think these things go together, but around the world, we increasingly see countries in which there are elections, but the second part of the kind of a package of democracy is not there.
Yeah. So would Russia fall in that category?
Yeah, I would say Russia's not even a liberal democracy. It's an outright authoritarian system. But I think some examples of countries that are illiberal democracies, Hungary today, where you have elections. There's not much election fraud, actually, it turns out. But there's decreasing, that you have a kind of tilting of the playing field, so it makes it harder and harder for minorities to win elections. Mm-hmm. Turkey is another country that's, I would argue, is an illiberal democracy. We continue to have elections. Elections are the only game in town, basically. Every country has elections, but are these other elements of what counts as democracy there? And in many of these countries, they're not.
I'll talk a little bit about the role of identity and culture in this. A couple things. One is that we're finding in our own country that people increasingly define themselves by their political affiliation. You know, I'm a Democrat or a Republican first. I'm a woman second. I'm an American third. I mean, it's sort of an unusual prioritization, which makes it pretty hard to talk to one another and listen to one another and view one another as legitimate, or at least one of us. Are you seeing that elsewhere? Is that particularly pronounced here today?
Yeah, so one of the key points in our book, and I think this applies around the world, is that one of the preconditions of democratic breakdowns, or one of the things you see before democracies break down, is extreme polarization, extreme party polarization. So whether one's talking about the 1920s and 30s in Italy or Germany, the 1960s and 70s in Latin America and Chile in 1973, you have extreme polarization. And so, you know, some polarization, disagreement among parties is absolutely a precondition for democracy. You need to have people disagree with each other. What extreme polarization, this different kind of polarization where one begins to view one's rivals not simply as rivals, but as enemies, as existential threats. And you become so fearful of one's rivals that you'll do anything to keep them out of power, to get them out of power. You know, whether that's a military coup, election fraud, cheating. But, you know, if you think your rival is really an enemy, it kind of makes sense to use those sorts of measures. So, you know, when politics reaches that level, it's really hard to get out of this. And this is what I think of as extreme polarization, and certainly a very dangerous phenomenon where, you know, and so there's actually a recent study by a political scientist at Yale where he does these surveys of, he first did this study in Venezuela, but now has done this in the United States, where if you essentially ask in a highly polarized setting, if you showed us respondents, survey respondents, that the person on their side is violating democratic rules, will they still vote for their person over the person of the other political party? And people are increasingly willing on both sides of the aisle in the United States to look over violations on their own side because they identify with the party. Another kind of incredible statistic, so there was a survey done in the early 60s asking Americans, how would you, you know, would you be upset if your child married somebody of the other political party? And 5% of Americans, roughly 5% on both sides, said that they would be upset about this. Today, that number is 50%. So, you know, this is a kind of deep level of animosity, and it's, and when one doesn't regard one's rivals as just rivals that you'd maybe dislike and disagree with, but think have a fundamental right to exist and compete, then it's hard to sustain a democracy.
You even feel that in Washington, D.C., where wherever you live, your next-door neighbor works for the guy or the woman who beat your guy, you know, your boss, and you know that you share a value. You share a commitment to country, you share a commitment to public service, and the rest is about tactics, and the other side's tactics are legitimate. They're wrong, but they're legitimate. Even in a town like that, where one is forced to bump up against folks of the other party who are in fact rivals, even there, you're seeing folks not talk to each other and not going to cocktail parties together. I keep thinking that part of what makes us robust as a civil society, is that we do interact, right? Right. We do solve problems together, whether it be in your city block or your wider neighborhood or city. Are you seeing, as part of the solution to this problem here, the kind of new localism we're hearing about, in which individuals are running for local office, but they're also forming groups that take on local problems?
Yeah, well, I think there is some hope in that. I mean, in general, we're extremely polarized. I don't think we've become any less polarized over the last several years. So it's nice to try to find some silver linings and things. But it is true that there are lots of groups developing now where people are very self-consciously trying to reach out to people across the aisle and form different kinds of civic organizations, both at the local level as well as the national level. But what's striking about a lot of these organizations, and I'm often invited to these kinds of meetings, is that the membership is often secretive. I mean, because people are afraid, if you're an elected official and you're willing to show that you're able to interact with other people from the other side, you might actually get punished electorally for this. Right. So this is a vice, not a virtue. You know, everyday citizens, certainly I think focusing on problems, I mean, one of the great lessons of the integration of the creation of the European Union was, you know, if you think about it, there's few more polarized settings than Germany and France after World War II. And the way that the European Union was founded was, you know, through a very mundane activity, which is governing coal and steel. And so the idea was German and French bureaucrats can get together and negotiate, try to solve very small problems. And by doing that, they develop trust. And you kind of create a feedback loop where there needs to be further cooperation to solve additional problems. You get expanding zones of trust. And that's how the European Union was created. That's how peace was restored. And I think that actually can happen in our politics as well.
But we see in our polling the vast reduction in trust, not only trust in institutions of governance, but trust in one another in the U.S. Do you see, you seem to be saying you see some hopeful signs there, but the polls are not encouraging.
Yeah, I think, you know, we do have low levels of trust in our political system, but I think that's less concerning to me than the attitudes of political rivals towards each other. Right. And in many ways, actually, it's partly a problem of normal citizens interacting with each other, but it's also about our political class. You know, so you mentioned D.C. I mean, I was recently in D.C. and talking to some Senate staffers, and that the thing that I hear over and over is people saying, you know, we just have different temperaments. Democrats and Republicans have different temperaments. We're from different planets, which I find frightening that people are saying this, because that, you know, that's a precursor to kind of, I mean, it sounds as if, you know, we're different ethnicity, different nationalities or something. And so I think, you know, that's more worrying to me, actually, than distrust in the political system.
They are the other.
Right, exactly.
Norms. You write about in your book with your co-author the breakdown of norms. These are stated and unstated rules by which we govern ourselves, both politically, but our interactions with one another. What are the early signs of a breakdown of norms, political norms in particular, here in the U.S.?
Well, so norms are unwritten rules, so they're hard to see. You don't really see them until they're being violated. And one of the points of our book is that the Constitution of the United States is not enough. mean, we have a very short constitution, and according to the constitution, the president could pardon whoever he or she likes at any point for any reason. The Congress can block any president's nomination for the Supreme Court for any reason. The House of Representatives could impeach the president for any reason. Up until the 1950s or after Roosevelt, presidents could be president for life. They could run for president. You know, there was no limits on presidential reelection. The fact that none of this stuff has happened is because of a set of unwritten rules, a set of behaviors that if one violated the behaviors, you would get your kind of a finger shaking at you. And people kind of shared these norms. And the two norms that we talk about that are particularly important in our democracy are, one, this norm of mutual toleration, where you treat your rival, again, no matter how much you despise them or dislike them or disagree with them, as legitimate. And then the second norm, which is a little bit harder to kind of see or is a little more unfamiliar, is the norm we call forbearance. And the norm of forbearance is essentially self-restraint. That even though you may be very powerful and have a constitutional right to do things, you step back from the brink. It's a kind of self-conscious underutilization of power. Politicians in our system of our presidential system, where you might have divided government, these two norms are critical. Without them, the system turns into a system of dysfunction and deadlock. And so what we began to see in the United States beginning in the 1990s were politicians attacking these basic norms and accusing their rivals of being treasonous or not being loyal to the country or not loving their country, and politicians pushing to the max, and, you know, government shutdowns, partisan impeachments, and this really the increased use of the filibuster. I mean, there was more use of the filibuster in the second term of Obama's presidency than for large portions of the entire 20th century combined. And so this kind of hardball politics is in many ways a kind of key sign, I think, of the violation of these norms.
Yeah. I think now about at the end of Obama's term, or not quite, in fact, a year from his the end of his term, the refusal of senators to even meet with, let alone grant a hearing for Merrick Garland.
Right. That was in my mind
Supreme Court.
The most egregious violation, I think. There was something that hadn't happened since the 1860s. I mean, they have the constitutional right to do this, again, but it's a kind of hardball tactics. And so one of the interesting things is why is this happening? I think, we argue in our book that it's being driven by polarization. If you regard your rival as an enemy, then you're going to use any means necessary to stop your rival.
And then they changed the rules in order to confirm Neil Gorsuch. Wasn't it a two-thirds vote, and they went from there to a simple majority?
Essentially got rid of the filibuster for Supreme Court appointees.
Many people think of Gingrich, as Newt Gingrich, as being kind of the beginning of this breakdown of norms. But you could also argue that changes in the media added to that. He took advantage of C-SPAN.
Right.
He really understood that he could stand all alone on the House floor at 3 a.m. giving a long speech, and knew that there was an audience out there for it. But you also had the rise of talk radio, which didn't seem very grounded in facts. I mean, it was sort of screaming and demonizing. And now we've got cable TV, and we don't have a fairness doctrine anymore. So there's a legal change, a change in policy. But there's also a technology change. So talk about the role of the media and what the information revolution has done to the media, because it's not just sort of purposefully trying to discredit the media. There's also a business model that in flux.
Yeah, so we argue that Newt Gingrich was the original kind of hardball politician in our era. I mean, he was taking advantage of an opportunity that he saw. And, you know, people on different sides of the political aisle can actually disagree with this. I mean, this is something for historians to debate where this began. At some level, you could sort of say it doesn't really matter where it began, because we're in the situation we're in now and we have to figure out how to get out of it. But it is important to try to understand where it came from. And I think you're right that Gingrich began this, but he saw these opportunities in C-SPAN, taking advantage of C-SPAN. But he also saw an increasingly polarized political environment that was driven in part by media, but also driven by other demographic changes that I could talk about. And economic changes. But certainly the media environment has exacerbated this. And this is all before the rise of social media. And, you know, I think what's really become clear is social media, you know, we're ill-equipped to cope with this new environment. And the rise of social media and the kind of fake groups, Facebook groups, and the spreading of misinformation, exacerbates. And social scientists have only recently begun to study this in very careful ways and begun to see, for instance, there's this kind of echo chamber effect where if you expose people to only media they agree with over an extended period of time, they shift further to the right. What's interesting is the findings don't find huge shifts to the right. People are often already, you know, pretty far to the right or to the left, but it exacerbates the problem, certainly. So this contributes to the polarization. But at the end of the day, we make the case in our book that driving this is that as important as media is, and I certainly think Fox News and the elimination of the fairness doctrine has exacerbated this, that there are deeper sociological divisions within our society that this is, that the media, this kind of media environment is allowing to even get worse. I mean, so these deeper sociological trends and economic trends, I think, are even more fundamental than media, I would argue anyway.
But you do have a purposeful effort to discredit traditional sources of information. I always think of those sources of information as, there was real authority to what the New York Times wrote, you know, or what the three networks put forth. There was a sense that, okay, these are the facts and on which we can build a consensus. But if you have disputed facts, I don't know how you avoid seeing compromise as capitulation, which is, seems to be the current mood.
That's right. And I think it's so I'm teaching a course at Harvard this semester with a group of freshmen, and this is one of the topics we're spending a lot of time exploring. And, you know, it hadn't occurred to me that, you know, I grew up in an age when there was three television stations, and that they, you know, this is something very unfamiliar. These are students who were born in 2000, so this is something totally unfamiliar to them. And so they don't really understand, this transformation that has taken place, or, you know, they're beginning to see it, I think. The question, though, is what do we do about this? Because you can't put the genie back in the bottle. I mean, mm-hmm. I think we're in a situation where there's market competition, and so the best I can think of is that we need to arm our citizens with better capacities mm-hmm. to deal with the onslaught of false information. And, I think there's a kind of renewed interest in the role of civics education, for instance. Yeah. So during the 1930s, in fact, there was this incredible initiative undertaken by this organization called the Institute for Propaganda Analysis, which was sort of organized by some sociologists and psychologists to train school children to inoculate them from the appeals of totalitarianism was the phrase then. So fascism and communism. And so in lots of elementary school curriculum around the country, there was a curriculum which emphasized encouraging children to identify the hallmarks of propaganda, stacking the deck and sort of techniques of propaganda. This is something that has kind of gone to the side. And I think there's increasing attention and realization that in this new social media environment, unless, you know, there's going to be the nationalization of media, which I wouldn't argue for, I think that the best solution is to train our citizens, especially our young citizens in schools, to be able to cope with these environments and develop the critical thinking skills that are absolutely critical for democracy. You know, we've had this sort of long view, I think, for a long time, or at least the period that I've been growing up, in which we think, you know, democracy takes care of itself. But I think the last several years in the United States and around the world has made it clear that we need to defend democracy. Mm-hmm. Democracy is a very fragile species. And so part of that is training citizens to be robust, active democratic citizens.
Yeah. I mean, I was raised to believe, when thinking about the First Amendment, that more information drives out bad information. You know, just put out more good information and it will work out.
Right.
So that's, the media is one institution. It's an essential civil society actor when it comes to self-governance. What about other institutions that we have seen as independent and as essential to a functioning democracy? For example, the judiciary, the court system.
Yeah, I think, you know, so when we think about our various systems of checks and balances that are supposed to help maintain our democracy, media is certainly one that's a social institution. The judiciary is another. And I think, by and large, lawyers have done a very good job. I mean, the profession of lawyer, you know, that have done a very good job. And there's a kind of denseness to our legal institutions and the kind of decentralization of our judicial institutions mm-hmm. with circuit courts and state courts and at state attorney generals helping protect our democracy. And I think these, in many ways, the one of the most significant differences between the United States and other countries that have experienced democratic backsliding, such as Hungary, such as Turkey, is the robustness of our judicial institutions and the independence of our judicial institutions.
But seen as increasingly politicized. Is that a fair observation?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, the recent Supreme Court hearings were, you know, a case in point, and this, you know, people are increasingly questioning the legitimacy of the Supreme Court. I mean, is this just simply a political body, or is it this myth that it's above politics? You know, given that it's not really above politics, why do we have any deference to it? And there are people on the left arguing is, you know, that maybe we should, instead of trying to pursue social change through our judicial institutions, we should do it through legislative institutions. I mean, I think that's unrealistic. I mean, there's an important role for judicial review in the United States. And so, you know, we need to continue to fight over these institutions. But I think by and large, you know, the fact that we have this highly decentralized set of judicial institutions, you know, so one of the things that happened in Hungary very early on under Viktor Orban's rule was he changed the retirement age of judges in this highly centralized political system. So all these judges were forced out. So then he was in this position to appoint a bunch of new judges. So it was a kind of stacking of the court. You know, in the United States, people argue that there's stacking of the court going on, but it's much more constrained than it has been in other countries. And so this is one of the strengths of our political system. Mm-hmm. Our legislative institutions have not done such a great job. I would say for the first year and a half, 2 years of the Trump administration, the Congress, which is really supposed to be a watchdog of democracy, has really been much more of a lapdog. And it's part of this kind of level of partisan polarization has turned these institutions or legislative institutions into kind of really weak institutions.
Yeah. There have been sort of some seemingly cynical moves that would reduce public faith even in our elections. And, you know, the efforts to depress voter turnout, in some situations, moving the polling booth to, you know, a mile out of town with no public transportation. And accusations by President Trump, claims that there's widespread voter fraud, and Vice President Pence as well. How serious is this? Are people, do you see this as A, successfully depressing the vote, but B, raising real concerns about the legitimacy of the outcome?
Yeah, this is one of the most worrying things I think that have been going on over the past 2 years. In our book, we talked about the Kobach Commission, which was sent up right after Trump took office to kind of examine election fraud. It ended up being disbanded, which was a good thing. I think that it was disbanded. This was to investigate what they argued was a rampant election fraud. Although there's all social scientists make clear that this is completely exaggerated. I think it is very worrying because really, you know, a couple of things that elected autocrats do, you know, the way that democracies die today is at the ballot box. So people come to office through elections and then once in office attack democratic institutions. And the way this usually happens is by first capturing the referees of the state. So that means the judicial institutions. Second, going after the opposition and opposition media portraying the media, impartial media as opposition media. But the third big thing, and I think this is really important, is the tilting of the playing field. This is turning our institutions over the long run, entrenching the incumbent, making it harder and harder to dislodge the incumbent. So one of the things that Viktor Orban did in Hungary was change the electoral system so that it was much easier for him to win re-election, he got a supermajority of the seats in the parliament without getting a supermajority of votes in the electorate. Similar things have taken place in other countries. So when you see efforts to kind of monkey around with our electoral institutions, in effect what you're seeing is an effort to protect a minority in office. Yeah. And once these are altered, we've lost the kind of key instrument of leverage. I mean, the most powerful point of leverage are our votes and our electoral institutions. And so that's why this is really a key thing. And I think that it's, you know, there's lots of attention to this. It's taking place at the state level, but, you know, it's certainly a vulnerability of our political system.
Mm-hmm. Now, at the same time, there seems to be a lack of real interest in ferreting out the degree of Russian meddling using social media primarily, both in 2016, but also continuing into 2018.
Yeah, you know, though it's a lot of people have debated how decisive was this. I mean, there's certainly signs of Russian meddling in the election and lots of evidence of this. But the question of whether, you know, the election was so close that there's like 25 different causes that all were decisive. And I think it's possible the Russian election was, but, you know, the Russian intervention was, you know, and Russian intervention meaning the kind of manipulation of social media.
Sowing of divisions.
Yeah, and the sowing of divisions.
But did it have to be decisive to matter?
It's unacceptable and under any circumstances. Yeah. Whether it was, you know, made the key difference or not, that's sort of a matter of dispute at this point.
Gerrymandering.
Yeah, gerrymandering has always happened throughout history. It's named after an old, congressman from Massachusetts. So this has happened throughout history. So in some sense, I think gerrymandering is less of a concern. I mean, a lot of people argue gerrymandering is a driver of polarization, that politicians create these homogeneous districts. That plays some role, but it turns out political scientists that's one driving force of the polarization, but there's another driving force, which is a kind of natural demographic shift, which is that Democrats tend to cluster together in urban areas and Republicans tend to cluster on average in less urban areas. And so because you have this kind of concentration, and it has to do with the structure of our economy, we have these kind of parts of the U.S. economy and regions where there's these booming economies, where there's low unemployment, lots of migration, whether San Francisco or Boston, where I live. I mean, you see these are areas where there's lots of Democratic voters, where there's no competitive districts, and then you have large parts of the country where there's not many Democrats living. And I think a lot of this is driven by the structure of our economy. And so this is a kind of natural gerrymandering in effect that takes place that I think is partly dry, that may even be more important than the partisan gerrymandering.
Yeah.
We've been hearing from Harvard scholar Daniel Ziblatt. He's co-author of How Democracies Die. After the break, we'll consider what the exit ramps might be on the road to authoritarianism. You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. We're hearing from Daniel Ziblatt. He's a professor at Harvard University and co-author of a new book, How Democracies Die. To hear this broadcast or any other World Affairs program that you may have missed, you can download our podcasts from our iTunes channel or wherever you get your podcasts. Search for World Affairs, that's one word. And now back to our conversation.
Many of us feel that a commitment to pluralism is the sine qua non of our democracy. That is the notion that multiple cultures can live side by side within a larger shared society. And that once we lose that commitment to pluralism, our democracy becomes endangered. To what extent has demographic change affected the way we think about who we are as a nation and led to some of this polarization?
Well, you know, if you look back to the 1960s or, early 60s, late 1950s, the two major, although America was a diverse society, the two major parties basically culturally looked very similar. I mean, the political parties were essentially mostly white, Christian, and politicians were male. I mean, if you looked at Republican, Democratic candidates for office, they looked pretty similar. This passed across all levels of office, governors' mansions as well as presidents, U.S. senators, members of Congress. Beginning in the 1960s, three big changes took place that speak exactly to this. One, you had the full democratization of the United States through the passage of the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act. And the mass migration of Southern Democrats, previously Southern Democrats, to the Republican Party, and African Americans primarily ending up in the Democratic Party. You had it, that was the first big thing that happened. The second big thing that happened right around simultaneously with this was a massive wave of migration that began as a result of reforms in the mid-1960s, and many of these immigrants and their children ended up in the Democratic Party. And then the third big change was the shift of evangelical Christians who had previously been evenly divided roughly between Democrats and Republicans to the Republican Party. So by the time you get to the 1980s, we had this transformed environment in which rather than two kind of very similar looking parties, you have one political party, the Democratic Party, which is a kind of rainbow coalition of urban educated whites and a collection of ethnic minorities, and the Republican Party, which is still primarily a party of white Christians. And so having these two demographically very different parties, I think, has contributed to the level of polarization because, you know, white Christians aren't just any group. I mean, they were once the dominant group in American society, the majority and, in terms of status, the highest status group. I mean, governors' mansions, college professors, sports stars, news anchors were all white male Christians. That those days are long gone. And so losing status and losing one's majority status is deeply threatening. And so I think a lot of the polarization that we're witnessing today is a function of this. Now, you know, personally, I think these demographic changes are all to be applauded, and they've enriched American society, but it certainly has contributed to polarization. And so the question of how you combine a multi-ethnic society and overcome these kind of dynamics of polarization is the chief challenge, I think, that American society faces today. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. There's a writer who is based in a conservative think tank in Washington. His name is Pete Wehner. I don't know if you mm-hmm. know him, but he is he's a conservative. He was served in the second Bush administration, and he's written a lot on the fact that the most aggrieved population is the one that's most politically powerful right now, and that's white male Christians, and trying to figure out how could they feel aggrieved, and he is one of those. How can they feel aggrieved when they are in fact the most powerful? One of the audience members asked whether the decline, this goes back to the trust issue, but the decline of faith in religious institutions, organized religion, whether it's been a major factor in weakening our democracy, in part because it's part of social capital.
Yeah, I haven't thought much about the decline of religious institutions and what effect that has had on American society. I mean, I think in general, the decline of institutions, whether labor unions or religious institutions, where people have the opportunity to interact with people unlike themselves. Right. I mean, having kind of great social mixers. I think of these kinds of institutions as opportunities to talk to people that are different, come from a different background, may have different ideologies. This is really critical for democracy, and this helps at the kind of very the everyday level of citizens to create trust. And so, in that sense, I think it plays a role. I think there's other ways this can also happen, though. You know, as I say, through labor unions, through religious institutions, through public institutions, public libraries, other public, public basic, architecture of our cities and our daily lives. You know, do people have the opportunity to interact with people they don't know in a kind of sustained way? And this is something that we don't really, this kind of infrastructure of public life is really critical for democracy.
Right. And whether public libraries have given away to people sitting alone at home looking at their, right. Googling
There's a wonderful book by Eric Kleinenberg called Palaces for the People, in which he makes the case that these kinds of public institutions are really a key to reducing polarization.
Yeah. So other questioners ask the relationship between the concentration of wealth on the one hand and the health of our democracy. I'm going to let you answer that and then go on to others.
Yeah, well, this is certainly one of the most striking figures I've seen in the last 6 months, I would say, is that I saw this in The Economist magazine. If you look at productivity rates in the United States from 1945, of the U.S. economy, from 1945 to 2016, you see a kind of straight diagonal line up. I mean, the economy's gotten more and more productive. If you look at the average or median wage growth in that same period, you see a perfectly parallel line to that line. As productivity increases, median wages go up, as they should, because people are being more efficient in their labor. But suddenly in 1981, you get a flat line. And so that disjuncture between the kind of general state of the economy and the experience of people's lives, you know, where people's wages are not increasing, has contributed to inequality. Mm-hmm. And in conditions of high economic inequality, combined with a lot of these demographic changes that we've been talking about, create people, you know, results in a situation where you have people who are feeling vulnerable and looking for somebody to blame. And so the combination of these things has been a real problem for our democracy. And so I sometimes imagine a kind of counterfactual world. Had the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act and the big wave of migration that began in the 1960s all passed, let's say, in 1948, and you then had 30 years of uninterrupted economic growth, you know, that we would be in a very different world, because what really happened was these reforms passed in the 1960s, and for reasons totally unrelated to that, beginning in the 1970s, the oil crisis, you had a basic slowdown in the economy, global economy. And so it was the combination of these things in an environment where people's salaries are no longer increasing at the rates they once were much more vulnerable to populist politics.
Right. So, and part of that story is the 2008... financial crisis that spread right through the world, and the 2009 crisis of the euro. And I think of that because those all took place or started in the most robust democracies in the world. Right. So what did it do to the reputation of liberal democracies as the source of stability and future prosperity?
Yeah, well, it certainly created crises within these countries. If you want to understand why there's, you know, such appeal to right-wing populist parties in Western Europe today, part of it's driven by immigration, but a lot of it's driven by economic disaffection and dislocation. And so a lot of this comes out of the 2008-2009 financial crisis. And I think similarly in the United States, you see similar things. What the reputation more broadly on liberal democracy, that's an interesting question. I hadn't thought of that. You know, what is clear is that I think the U.S. has actually recovered pretty well in mm-hmm. response. I mean, we have avoided full-blown economic catastrophe. And so I think in a way, compared to previous examples of economic crisis, the Great Depression, for instance, we avoided that fate. And so I think there has been incredible learning in terms of economic policy and Federal Reserve policy since the 1930s and the need for expansionary spending. I mean, I personally don't think there was enough, you know, in the early days of the financial crisis. But nonetheless, we've learned a great deal. So I think liberal democracies are better off than they once were. But certainly the existence of the financial crisis and the fact that it even happened has made people look to other models. I mean, China, for example, is a model that other people around the world look at as a successful economy.
And what about practice on Wall Street? Are we doing some of the same things that got us into trouble to begin with?
Yeah, you know, it's worrying. I mean, there's a lot of the regulations that were reintroduced after the financial crisis are now being undone. And so it's not clear that everybody has learned their lessons. And so, you know, I think we are probably vulnerable.
Talk a little bit about the relationship between markets on the one hand and government policy on the other, because I recently read what's his name, Ellis, I can't think of his first name, Richard Ellis maybe, mm-hmm. has done a book that does a little bit what you do, and that is to go back historically to see what did our founding fathers have in mind, and is it exactly what we're claiming now they did, and points out that John Adams argued that democracy and unfettered capitalism couldn't coexist.
Yeah.
That in order to preserve democracy, you had to have the government play a role in regulating markets. And we've kind of gone back and forth with this in our lifetime. I mean, there's Keynesian economics were the dominant, then Milton Friedman. I don't quite know what now, but it seems to be heavily focused on deregulation and sort of a hands-off, a small government when it comes to markets.
Yeah, so the degree to which inequality is a threat to democracy, for the reasons that I just laid out before, I mean, tells you something about the relationship of capitalism and democracy. Because under capitalism, of course, there's winners and losers. There's competition, so you have winners and losers. And so, but what's striking is that you have varying levels of economic inequality around the world. I mean, there's not. I would say there may be some tensions in sort of in a general principled level between capitalism and democracy. But our political systems have developed techniques of taking the rough edges off capitalism. And if you look historically, you know, there was higher levels of inequality in the past in the United States. There was a period after World War II where inequality in the United States declined. And there's increasing inequality today. That happens to parallel the kind of general sense that our democracy, you know, there was a period of where things were working well and that's not working so well today. Also looking cross-nationally in countries where inequality is lower, there's a sense in which maybe democracy is more secure. And so under conditions of unfettered capitalism, you're more likely to have high levels of inequality. And this certainly poses a greater threat to the stability of democracy.
Certainly in the case of both Brazil and Mexico, one of the set of conditions was extraordinary inequality.
That's right. And you know, and it's connected to there was a corruption scandal so on, but this is related.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. As you look at the trends in American society, do Americans trust that their government can now actually solve hard problems? Or as they look at problems like, I'll take a dramatic example, it's climate change, mm-hmm. an inability to take the steps that certainly would appear to be necessary, inability to do anything that requires sacrifice today for benefit tomorrow.
In general, democracies have a challenge with this because politicians think short term. They have short term time horizons. They're, you know, in the case of members of the House of Representatives, they're interested in being reelected in 2 years. So to make their constituents suffer today for some benefit down the road is always going to be difficult under a democracy. You know, but there's ways in which these trade-offs can be managed. And I think, you know, part of it has to do with political courage, certainly, of political leaders. But part of it has to do with a consensus about what the problems are. And so this gets back to, I think, the point you made about the kind of fragmentation of the media environment. And, you know, if people can't even agree that global climate change, for instance, is a problem, then it's harder to impose costs on electorates. But I think a third big point is, you know, that the Republican Party in the United States, this is pretty striking, is the only center-right party in any advanced democracy that at the highest level of the party denies climate change. I mean, every other center-right party around the world accepts climate change and is trying to take measures to adopt it. So in some sense, part of the problem is disaffection or distrust of our institutions, but part of it is that one of the two major actors in the political game isn't willing to admit publicly that it's a problem. Mm-hmm. And so given this, at some level, it doesn't really matter what citizens think. I mean, this is a major problem.
So the short-termism and the inability to solve hard problems kind of come together in that if you disagree about the solutions to environmental degradation or climate change, the easiest way to deal with that is to say the problem doesn't exist.
Right.
Or in the case of, you know, if the cost to you of the solutions is so unappealing. Or in the case of President Trump has said, of course, the climate will change, but it'll change back, which is a very hopeful look at the problem. Three of the questions go to the heart of white nationalism. And I wonder the degree to which white nationalism is on the rise or the degree to which it's suddenly visible. Speaking of norms, if you're a white nationalist, this was not something you were very public about in the past.
In the United States, right. Yeah. Well, I mean, one thing I would say, I mean, there is a sense that it's become more visible and people are more open about it. But I think it's important to recognize that, you know, there was no golden age of American history where racism and white nationalism didn't exist. You know, one of the points we make in our book is that there's a long tradition in American life. I mean, there's alongside a very robust liberal democratic tradition in the United States, there's also a long tradition, an authoritarian tradition. Just in the 20th century alone, Henry Ford was considering running for president. The founder of Ford Motor Company was a famous anti-Semite and was actually quoted in the first edition of Mein Kampf, in Hitler's Mein Kampf. Charles Coughlin, Father Coughlin, the Catholic radio personality. I mean, we were talking earlier about the kind of proliferation of you know, right wing or fragmentation of the media landscape. Father Coughlin had tens of millions of listeners on his radio stations in the 1930s. Joe McCarthy, George Wallace in the 1960s. I mean, if you look at a lot of his rhetoric, it mirrors a lot of the rhetoric we see today. So I think there is, in fact, a long subcurrent in American political life of politicians and voters who like those politicians embracing this sort of thing. And in fact, there's, you know, each of these figures I just mentioned, according to Gallup poll data, we look back in writing this book at Gallup poll data going back to the 1930s, and there's always been this question, do you have a favorable and unfavorable opinion of various politicians? And each of these figures had around 35-40% favorability ratings in the United States. Charles Lindbergh is another, the famous pilot. So in the 1930s and 40s. So the point is that this has always existed. I think what's transformed, two big things. One, that these sorts of figures are no longer fringe characters, that we increasingly have people in the mainstream of our political life who speak in these ways. This is something really unprecedented. And second of all, by having this, the fact that this has become mainstream has made it more publicly acceptable. And so I think part of trying to understand what's been happening just in the last several weeks, you know, is that, you know, there's crazy people out there. They hear this message and they embrace it. And so I think it's very, certainly very dangerous. You know, and there's this, you know, a lot of people talking about, do words matter? I mean, two ways in which words matter. I mean, this is not exactly on your question, but the attacking of the legitimacy of elections. If you look at surveys, you know, as politicians have more and more said that elections are fraudulent, more and more Americans think elections are fraudulent. Mm-hmm. As politicians have more and more said that the press is the enemy of the people, if you look at surveys, more and more people think that there's a conspiracy in the media and it's all very corrupt. And so I think similarly, when it comes to white nationalism, if you have leading political figures speaking in these ways, it creates, there's a kind of echo effect where people begin to mimic the rhetoric that they hear their leaders. Mm-hmm.
Your mention of George Wallace takes me back to an experience I had when I was in my 20s, where I was in a conversation with the head of the Democratic National Committee, Robert Strauss of Texas. So exactly what you picture as the head of the Democratic National Committee, a large, charismatic Texan. And I said, help me understand how this works. You're head of the Democratic National Committee. What happens if George Wallace wins the nomination? What is your job then? And he said, honey, you go into the voting booth, you close your eyes, and you pull the lever for the Republican. In your book, you suggest that the political parties should do more to restrain the George Wallaces of the world. Now is the time of institutions that are weakened. Political parties are dramatically weakened, in part because there are PACs. The parties no longer control where the money goes for campaigns, and their power is gone. So what is your, how do you, if you were to kind of lay out the steps for Democrats or Republicans and the institutions that serve them, if you lay out the steps for them to, you know, offer some guardrails, what would it look like? Is it possible now?
Well, for the first three quarters of the 20th century, you had the way that our candidates selected through the smoke-filled back room, which, you know, had a lot to criticize about it. It wasn't democratic. It wasn't inclusive. Wasn't transparent. You know, the people got together at convention time and decided who the candidate would be. Political leaders would get together and they would decide. They had seen the, it was a kind of, the political scientists at the time called it a system of peer review, where they had seen these other politicians up close. They'd seen them in moments of triumph and moments of crisis, and they knew who would be a potential demagogue. And so they would select, and there was a, for all that one can criticize about the system, it actually worked quite well in keeping these sorts of figures like George Wallace out. After 1972, the system was opened up and in some sense made more democratic. I mean, in the way that now we have primaries and voters in the long primary season choose the candidates for their parties. And so this is more inclusive, it's more democratic, it's more transparent. But it also means that the road is much clearer for a potential demagogue. And so the Democratic Party coped with this dilemma by introducing in the early 1980s a system of superdelegates, where party, so-called superdelegates, they didn't call themselves, this is what the press calls the superdelegates, where party leaders had some votes to help select the candidate, and kind of an extra guardrail in a sense. The Republican Party never had introduced this. And so, I mean, you know, in many ways, I think, you know, had the Republican Party had a system of superdelegates in 2016, you might have had a very different outcome, where party leaders might have picked a different candidate. Or the party, you know, the party leaders would have had more of an influence. This might have served as a deterrent for Donald Trump to even get in the race in the first place. What's amazing is that the Democratic Party has now, in the last several months, reformed its system of candidate selection and essentially gotten rid of superdelegates. Now, there continue to be the superdelegates, elected officials, local elected officials, but they're not allowed to vote on the first ballot of the candidate selection. So essentially, the Democratic Party has introduced so although the Republican Party really had a crisis, I would say, of its candidate selection system, it's the Democratic Party that's reformed its system and made it more like the Republicans. Now, there's probably people sitting here, listeners or audience members, who are thinking, well, this is a good thing. The Smokeville backroom wasn't so great. It wasn't democratic. You know, and if we had a more inclusive system, things would be better. And there's a lot to be said for that. But on the other hand, it is also true that this system is a double-edged sword. The system is more vulnerable. What can be done about it? You know, I think that there is an important role for elected leaders in helping select the candidates for the party, for the parties. And, you know, I think in 2020, what we're likely to see is a proliferation of celebrity candidates who have no political experience, running a similar kind of campaign that Donald Trump ran in 2015-16, you know, and it's, I guess we can decide whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. I tend to think it's actually, this probably won't make me popular, but I tend to think it's a bad thing.
So it's Oprah v. Trump.
Right. Okay. Michael Avenatti or, you know, Howard Schultz. I mean, there's a lot of people who have no political experience who are considering, or so said to be considering, running for office.
So, former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright wrote a book called Fascism, in which she quoted Mussolini as saying, if you pluck the chicken one feather at a time, the chicken won't notice it. Do you feel like that's what's happening to democracy here?
Well, you know, democracy does die differently. At one point in the past, I mean, during the Cold War, three quarters of democratic breakdowns happened in the form of military coups. Since the collapse of communism, the majority of democratic breakdowns now happen at the ballot box through elections. As I said, somebody who comes to office through elections. And so has democratic legitimacy. You can't question the democratic legitimacy at some level of Donald Trump. He was elected, or of Hugo Chavez or Viktor Orban or Erdogan. These guys are elected by a majority of the voters. But then the question is, what happens once they're in office? And if they attack institutions in a subtle way, it's hard for voters to notice it. In Venezuela in 2011, so 12 years into Hugo Chavez's leadership, a majority of Venezuelans still thought they lived in a democracy. Mm-hmm. So voters often don't even notice it's happening. And so, you know, until it's too late. And so I think that's one of the reasons we wrote this book, was to kind of try to alert fellow citizens of the nature of the threats to democracy in the world today, not in the United States, but everywhere.
Because you are a professor as well and interact with the next generation, I wanted to make a point of using this question card that asked what you most fear for our country and what gives you the best hope. And as you look forward to the next generation, do you think they'll manage this better or worse?
Yeah, I think what gives me fear is that when I look for instances around the world where countries enter into the spiral of polarization, where each side increasingly views extreme measures as necessary to prevent the other side from getting into power. I mean, this kind of death spiral. It's really hard to find examples of countries breaking out of this. You know, and so that's frightening, where each side says, you know, if you're going to steal a Supreme Court seat, we're going to pack the Supreme Court. And then the next guys come and say, okay, we'll pack the Supreme Court. This spiral, it's really hard to think of examples of where this spiral ends well. Mm-hmm. So that's frightening. What gives me hope is that the U.S. is an old democracy. And as I have said before, old democracies tend to survive longer. Mm-hmm. And also what gives me hope is actually doing lots of public events where, over the last year, we see the kind of level of engagement of American citizens. And at some level, the robustness of American civil society. People are worried. People are decreasingly take American democracy for granted. And I think that's really critical. And so, I think, our electoral institutions still work. And so as long as there continue to be channels for democratic mobilization, at some level we have these instruments in our hands and we need to use them.
Yeah. Please join me in thanking Daniel Ziblatt for his remarks today, for joining us today, but also for a book that is a really terrific book. So I really recommend it to you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a nonprofit membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. Visit us at worldaffairs.org. This program featured a conversation with Daniel Ziblatt. He's a professor at Harvard University and co-author of the new book, How Democracies Die. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron, VMware, and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. Our technical supervisor is Jim Bennett. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.